Professional wrestling is the one true sport. Other sports have their share of intense, dramatic moments, but nothing can compare with professional wrestling. Welcome to Wrestling History X, where three friends come together to talk about the stories behind the matches. I'm Matt.
I'm in room 209.
What are you doing in Canada, man?
I'm here for the show.
Welcome to episode 260, In Your House 16.
Canadian Stampede.
Man.
Woo! We're in Canada, eh?
Hey.
It's not often.
Get us some Timbits from the Tim Hortons.
What was that?
Some Timbits from Timmy Hortons.
Timbits?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what are those? Cookies?
They're like his donut holes. Oh, yeah. Okay. Never been to a Tim Horton. Always wanted. Want to go to Harvey's. I've never been to a. I think they have Wawa's up there too, but they've got those here in the States, I believe. But
yeah, they got Wawa's in like Illinois. Yeah.
Oh,
really? Never been to a Wawa.
Yeah, I know it's East Coast.
Never been to the Cannabis Cafe. Never been over to the Canadian border.
Yeah, me neither.
I've never been to the Canadian border even.
Me neither.
One day. Closest I've been is Schitt's Creek. I'm going to find my way there sometime.
We can go to Niagara today, guys.
Well, this is the 16th rendition of In Your House, produced by WWF. It would take place on July 6th. 1997, from the Canadian Airlines Saddle Dome in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, with an attendance of 12,151 people.
That's a lot of Canadians.
I mean, you got the Heart Foundation.
So that's like 75% of their family there.
Yeah, in the town, it's like, yeah, how often does Canada get a wrestling show this big? So everybody's showing up.
Yep.
This big, probably never.
Yeah.
They got Stampede Wrestling, though, so.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they had, well, it wasn't Calgary, I guess. Toronto had the, you know, Mania 6, but.
That's a whole different
part
of the country.
It's Canada, but it's not this part.
Yeah, that's,
Different, completely different province.
Yes.
Yeah, this is, we're in the Oklahoma, Texas of Canada in Calgary.
Yeah. As Shane said last week, the deep north.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Robin, from How I Met Your Mother.
We are in Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
Yeah, we are.
So, Shane, did you do what you do?
I did some stuff. I did some things. I believe I did do what I do, and I may have done what I do a little more than what I normally do. Yes. We are in Canada. We're in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, home of the Hart family, home of the Canadian Stampede, home of Stampede Wrestling, and yeah, we're in your house, so you gotta have food, you gotta have beverages. I figured, why the hell not just bring both? So I did what I do, and I hopped on the old interwebs and said, what the hell do people eat in Calgary? What's Calgary known for? And apparently Matt found a list that was very similar to mine of what foods are known from Calgary, and here, let me pull it up, because it gave
like seven items.
Yeah, seven items that I was expecting to be like this big, I don't know, fancy foods type things.
Poutine and like poutine lamb fry.
Not on the list.
What about calf fry or whatever? Because I assume it's a cow. It's a cow place.
Seven signature foods listed by the Calgary Tourism Board. You have beef, because they like their cows. You have honey. You have canola.
We got bees.
Did you know
canola?
Canola,
like just oil,
is short for Canadian oil. I didn't know that. I always wondered that growing up. What the hell is canola oil? Because I just thought
where
it was a name.
Where does it come from then?
Canada.
No, what does the oil come extracted from?
Sunflower seed oil.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Red Fife wheat.
Whatever that is.
Saskatoon berries. Root vegetables.
This is so
Yeah, it's not broad. Like poutine or, you know, some sort of funky sandwich or something like that.
It's like, these are our major exports.
And then number 7 on the list, or I guess technically on the list, it's at the top, so maybe it's number 1, is what I brought for us today. Bison. Yes, it's twice the iron as beef and half the fat. Be used for tenderloins, short ribs, or in this case, for what I have for you today, burgers. I looked up what is the best bison burger in Oklahoma City, and they sent me to the garage. I don't know if that's technically the best bison burger, but it's kind of the only bison burger I've had in the last decade.
One of the only places that has bison on their menu.
Yes. It is an upcharge, but I figure, you know, you're in Oklahoma, we're, why not? We got bison on all of our signs and whatnot, so we're going to partake in eating the bison just like the Canadians do. So yeah, I went to the garage. Burgers and Beer, I believe is what their technical name is. And I got two different bison burgers. One of them is the Mushroom Swiss, which has a garlic aioli, lettuce and tomato, onions, sautéed shrooms, and Swiss. And then the other one is known as the Sticky Finger. It's peanut butter, bacon bits, sweet jalapeno relish, and cheddar cheese. I mean, they're pretty tasty. I'm guessing, I had them DoorDash, so I can only assume that having them fresh from the kitchen would be a little bit better, but they've got at least the shroom one. Or wait, no, I haven't taken a bite of the shroom one. I've had a bite of the Sticky Finger one, and I mean, you put peanut butter and bacon and jalapenos on anything, and I'm probably going to love it. But
I amazed people at work the other day with
putting peanut butter on a burger.
Putting peanut butter on a burger.
It's crazy how many people, I mean, I guess when I first heard about it, I probably had that same reaction of people put peanut butter on a burger.
It's been a thing for like over a decade now.
Since Elvis. I mean, it wasn't a burger, but
yeah. But still, it's like, I think I saw a commercial the other day for like Sonic doing it.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. The first peanut butter on a burger I ever had was from S&B.
It's the first time I heard of it.
That's the first time I ever heard
the
of
Elvis.
It.
Yeah. But now it seems like most burger restaurants. Yeah.
People think it's a weird thing. It's going to taste like peanuts, and it doesn't. It just adds a smoky quality to it. Unless you like slather that shit on there, then you're going to taste the peanut butter. But it's good.
It kind of takes the place of cheese on a burger, but this one also had cheese on it.
Yes. But then I also brought another thing because I was looking up. I don't know how often we're going to be in Canada, so I thought we're going to do this up. We're in your house. Got to have food. Got to have beverages. So what is a popular Canadian cocktail? Didn't know this until now or until today, but it is the Caesar. The Caesar is basically the Canadian Bloody Mary, only they use more of a Clamato twist to it instead of your typical Zing Zang tomato based. I mean, it's still tomato based, but it doesn't typically have the clam twist to it unless you are down in like Louisiana or something, getting them with oysters and shit inside of them. I cheated because I didn't want to follow the 17 ingredients that they had on the cocktail recipe, which at some point I'm going to have to because I'm very curious to see. I'm very curious to see how it is, though, with all that stuff in there. But I went the simple route and went to my local grocery store in their alcohol aisle and got the Michelada Clamato blend and then just add some vodka to it. I added an extra dash of Worcestershire sauce. It says you can kick it up with a little more hot sauce, but the Clamato Michelada, however the hell you want to say it, was supposed to have like onions and jalapenos in there too, so I didn't want to get too crazed with it. But it's pretty tasty. Garnished it with a little stalk of celery, a little squeeze of lime. I'm not going to take a bite of the burger on here, but I'm going to take a bite of the celery here because I know it's going to make some noise. So for all of you listening, let me clink my ice near the microphone, take a little sip, and then take a bite of my celery. Wonderful.
Yeah, I drink a Bloody Mary like maybe once or twice a year, and it's always great. And I'm like, why don't I have these more often?
It's typically heartburn?
No, I think it's just typically like a vacation breakfast thing whenever I have one where I'm like, you know.
And see, for me, it's like I enjoy them on weekends. They're good the morning of a hangover.
I think that's why I have them on vacation.
See, typically if I'm on vacation, I want something like fruitier.
But yeah finding a burger restaurant with a Bloody Mary at like 11 o'clock, waking up in a different state or country or whatever. It's always a good way to start.
Waking up on a bench in Mexico at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yep,
been there.
Yeah. Burgers were good, but I did not know it was bison until you said that out loud. It was like, and it just tasted like ground beef. So you know,
just leaner.
Like, yeah. I mean, I made sense when you said that. I was like, yeah, it's a little less. It's less greasy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, a movie that would come out to theaters right around the same time, Men in Black.
Mm-hmm. A masterpiece that has zero good sequels.
Yeah, I'd have to agree.
The third one is like almost okay, but it's not worth
rebooted.
It's not worth a rewatch. International is horrific, and two is also not good.
I could have just said my name was S.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
I didn't think the second one was like horrible.
It's not great. Real juice of the first movie is Tommy Lee Jones, and in the second one, he's like out of action for most of it. So it's just kind of.
That's so they can build that story in part three.
Oh yeah, sure. I'm sure that's what their plan was. So it's kind of a bummer. Like it's. Fine, for sure. But, I mean, the first one is such an easy watch, and it wastes no time. It's so fun. Yep. I rewatched it pretty recently, and, I was just like, man, this thing is just, so quick and so smooth and still incredibly funny. Will Smith, when he still had...
When he was still Will Smith?
When he still had...
before he became Will Smith.
Yeah, but, like, this, I guess, was kind of him... His first movie become, like, the king of the blockbuster.
Yeah,
or I guess maybe Independence Day was first.
Yeah, Independence Day was first, and then, you know, I think this was his Memorial Weekend follow-up of this is going to be my time of year to release a movie because
he
had back-to-backs, and then he got a little too cocky with it, and the Wild Wild West came along in another year or so, and just...
Jim West?
Which is crazy because as a kid, I saw Wild Wild West and I thought it was great. I was like, oh, this is really fun. But it's one of those things, in hindsight, it's like, oh, I didn't realize that everybody just shit all over this thing. I was like, cool, all the weird technology and trains.
He made a catchy song for this damn movie, but I still don't know how I feel. I guess I do know how I feel. It bothers me that he took the Forget Me Not song.
What Forget Me Not song?
That's the original song.
Oh, is it a Stevie Wonder sample?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy.
Like, I don't know if that's what it's called, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think... Is it Will Smith? But almost. The amount of Stevie Wonder samples in hip-hop is out of this world. Like, if you listen to the songs in the Key of Life, you'll be like, oh, I know all of these songs because all of them have been sampled in hip-hop songs.
Or did Stevie Wonder write it? I don't know. It says Patrice... Russian. I don't know. Sending out forget-me-nots to hope you will remember. Here come the men in black.
But, I mean, yeah, I saw this movie, like, opening weekend. I was probably, like, 9, and I left thinking, oh, this was the greatest thing I've ever seen. And it was pretty creepy at the beginning, too.
Am I really that much older than you? Maybe I am.
I guess so.
This was, like, right before I turned 20, so...
Well, yeah, I was... Born in, 87.
Yep, so, 10 years. Weird, I'm old.
You are.
Yes. Yep.
It's all right, you don't look it and you don't act it.
I try not to, both ways.
What? You know who else is old?
All the three of us collectively.
Like, I just want to throw in like the joke in your mom.
This podcast.
Oh.
It's our 5-year anniversary episode.
Woo!
Spitting it out into the ether for longer than most podcasts.
And never missed a week.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Pretty insane.
Even during a pandemic. I mean, that says a lot.
We were close during the pandemic.
The first and only time I've ever used Zoom or Skype or anything like that.
Yeah.
I remember listening to some of those and hearing like the drawn out occasional... Like metallic.
Yeah. In hindsight, if we ever had to do that again, I think we would have recorded our own audio.
Drinking a glass
and then synced
of
it back
water.
Yeah.
We definitely did not know quite what we were doing.
Well, I mean, there was paid professional podcast.
I'm not saying that we know what we're doing now either, but
a little more.
But yeah, it's like
I say we. You've learned a little more. We just sit here and talk into a microphone.
But a simple thing we could have done was just recorded and sync the audio.
Yeah,
which would have took us maybe an extra 20 minutes to figure out. But hey, it's okay.
Maybe we'll have to experiment with that down the line, just in case, you know, one of us ever goes out of town for an extended amount of time.
Well, if I'm on vacation, guys, you're doing it alone. You're doing it together. Yeah. There's three of us. One of us can take a sabbatical if we need to.
Go on assignment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk some In Your House. We get a new WWF logo package to start this one off. Mm-hmm. In over 100 countries, in 7 different languages, to more than a 500 million viewers each week, the WWF, worldwide leader in sports entertainment.
Oh, the precursor of then, now, forever, together.
I'm sure that they probably had something else in between, but yeah.
We go into a black and white video package that includes highlights of competitors with narration. We no longer live in a world of black and white. Good is indistinguishable from evil, and renegades receive a hero's embrace. Bret Hart was a beloved superstar for a decade, but a stone-cold killer has declared his intention to end the Hitman's legacy. The fan favorite is now the villain. Bret has traded arrogance for pride, turned his back on a nation, and reformed the Hart Foundation. Tonight, the paradox continues, because the rogues are beloved. The heroes are hated. In Your House is a devastating tempest. We then get the logo with the sound of mooing, followed by Pyro going off, with Vince McMahon welcoming us to the show, joined by Jerry Lawler and Jim Ross, with all three wearing cowboy hats, including the King's being a 20-gallon.
Yeah, it's like, it looks
cartoonish.
Yeah, and it's like kind of poorly made. Like, I don't know what material it's made out of, but it's very funny looking.
Yeah, I mean, it almost had that like circus foam, like foam finger hat look to it.
It's all, it's not very smooth either. It's like it's very, whoever put it together was in a hurry.
Yep, it's just held together with some twine that they found on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
They preview the matches of the night, including talking about two Japanese light heavyweights, which JR mispronounces. The great Suzuki. I mean, at least he does it phonetically, but it's, we all know that it's wrong because
we've seen him wrestle quite a bit.
Exactly.
Oh, is this the beginning of JR wearing a cowboy hat?
Regularly? He's been wearing it for a while.
Has he? Okay.
Yeah. He started, I want to say last year sometime.
Okay. It was probably the last like Southern show or whatever, maybe, where he's like, all right. And they're like, you know what? It looks good. Keep it, because your voice ain't changing.
So we go to our first match. Hunter Hearst Helmsley with China versus Mankind. And we get a recap video contrasting our competitors. Triple H was born with a silver spoon. Foley had a dream that became a nightmare, while seeing footage from King of the Ring and Raw where Mankind would want a rematch. But China just wanted him to kiss her ass. And Hunter wanted to break another crown over Foley's head. The Fink, he's making the announcements, is wearing a cowboy hat.
I mean, I love to see it.
I mean, we're in cow country.
We're in the deep north.
That's right. The home of the bison, or the northern home of the bison, something like that. You gotta have your cowboy hat on, represent. Makes so much sense now, seeing Bret Hart dressed up as a cowboy at different times.
Yeah.
Like, I never understood it before, because it's like, what are you doing?
You're like, Calgary, I don't know anything about that.
Calgary.
So Mankind makes his way out and goes right after Triple H, controlling the bout early on with a bulldog, scoop slam, leg drop, and a double arm DDT, before mocking Hunter with a curtsy. Foley then telegraphs a back body drop, allowing Triple H to nail a face crusher. But then Hunter charges into a back body drop that sends him out to the floor. And Mankind follows out with an elbow drop from the apron before rolling Triple H back in for a two count. Foley then whips Hunter to a corner for a flare flip out to the floor, with Mankind looking to hit a second rope something. But Triple H takes off towards the stage, only for Foley to follow, to suplex him on the steel ramp. And Hunter crawls his way back to the ring, with Mankind clotheslining back to the floor, but finally he re-enters with a sunset flip, only for Foley to stay up and mandible claw down. When China would deliver a forearm to knock Mankind away.
Ooh. Yep.
That's where I got my namesake this week. There was a sign that said, China, I'm in room 209.
That's okay. I do remember seeing a sign that said 209, but I didn't remember what it... I couldn't see what was said before that, so...
It was a pretty funny sign.
Because then they started talking about... commentators did about, you know, it's 200-pound China, so I thought maybe it was something that had to do with their weight.
Oh, yeah. She's 209 pounds, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
Foley rolls out to give chase when Triple H would fly off the apron, but Mankind turns in time to catch him in the gut before attempting to whip Hunter, only for it to be reversed, sending Foley towards China, who hip-tosses Mankind knee-first into the ring steps.
That looked like it hurt.
Yeah.
And China begins to distract the ref, allowing Triple H to grab a chair to use on the hurt leg, before they both make their way into the ring, where Hunter focuses on the leg with chop blocks, stomps, elbows, drop kicks, and a leverage-aided figure four, until the ref catches him. And Foley fires up with right hands and turnbuckle smashes, but a reversed whip causes Mankind to stumble out into a pedigree attempt, only for Foley to counter it into a double leg takedown, which Hunter kicks him away into a corner, followed by Mankind stumbling out again to headbutt the crown jewels.
Yeah, just almost does a Mick Foley flop and fall.
Yes.
Square in the nuts of one Hunter Hearst Helmsley.
Foley with more right hands, a running knee, and a tree of woe attack, before nailing a pulling pile driver and a clothesline that would send them both out to the floor. And Mankind grabs a chair, but China stops him from being able to use it, allowing Triple H to pick it up and use on Foley's leg again, followed by a China clothesline. And Mankind's rolled in while Hunter heads to the top, but Foley falls into the ropes, causing Triple H to crotch himself, allowing Mankind to lock on the mandible claw, only for China to trip him up and pull him ball first into the ring post.
Yeah, I sat there and just kind of laughed for a moment. I got slipped and slid ball first into the ring post.
Hunter follows out to keep up the attack by running Foley into a guardrail, taking the fight into the crowd when the bell rings for a double countout. Post-match, the brawl continues in the crowd where Mankind tosses Triple H into the penalty box.
So Canadian.
Yes.
China joins the fray until officials come out, only for Hunter to just shove them all aside as the brawl makes its way backstage.
I mean, I'm okay with this finish because it's kind of a trilogy of matches, and this isn't in your house, and it's the first match. Just heating it up a little bit more. There's obviously animosity, so they're doing it right.
So I'm trying to remember, did we get them at SummerSlam? Maybe. Who knows?
I assume the next match will be on a pay-per-view that they have. It would feel kind of wasted to do it on television, especially considering that it's a pretty hot mid-card feud. I mean, the crowd's hot, but it's also one of those things where it's not the same as a normal town U.S. crowd because there's 12,000 people here and they don't get to see wrestling shows on the scale often, if ever.
This crowd is on fire.
Yeah, it's great.
Vince sends us to a video package about the Calgary Stampede with Doc Hendricks' narration. And we get footage of the parade as the Hart Foundation rides afloat that includes the current Miss Calgary, who happens to be Diana Smith. Of course, she's the Bulldog's wife.
Yeah.
So is Miss Calgary like the equivalent of Miss Oklahoma?
Yeah, I just don't know.
I'd say it's probably like Miss Teen Oklahoma City, just so they have someone riding in the parade.
Oh, so she's like the Pinto Queen.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
But, you know, I believe that she's potentially the prettiest lady in Calgary.
Looks just like a mother.
Brett did an autograph signing with the line being a mile long, But the Hitman greeted every one of them. Goldust and the Legion of Doom received keys to the city before superstars competed in a tug of war with local fire and policemen. And we come back to the arena with Doc in the locker room, with the Hart Foundation saying their reputation is on the line. That if they lose on their home turf, it could be devastating. But Brett has had enough of Hendricks, only for Stone Cold to interrupt before the Hitman can complain. And officials hold Austin back as Brett accuses him of looking for excuses, saying the Foundation won't attack him, as that would be 5-on-1. That they will wait till it's 5-on-5 in the ring, and that's where they'll get the job done.
Whoa.
Because, you know, they're the faces in Canada.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we go to our second match. Taka Michinoku versus the Great Sasaki.
I mean, I'm excited. This is a match we would be seeing on WCW over the last year or so, typically. As far as lighter guys that are from Japan and work that style.
And it's Sasuke, remember? This is Canadian-American.
I'm going to go with the correct pronunciation, Sasuke. And as they enter the ring, we see Mankind and Triple H continue to brawl in the stands, with Hunter being knocked over a guardrail, so China attacks Foley. Triple H is busted open as Mankind rams Hunter into the side of a stage before taking him through a door.
I do have to specify as well, or whatever word I'm trying to say here. The feminizing of China has already begun, if you had not noticed. She's gone from being a bodybuilder or bodyguard looking, wearing black pants and a black vest, and now she's showing some arms. She's showing her flatter cleavage that she has. She's showing off her legs. They've got her in like a little short skirt, short shirt, yeah, or short shorts, something
this,
like
this
that.
This is pre, but this is pre boob job and pre
chin shave. And, yeah.
Like, she's not a bad looking woman.
She's by just, any means. It's just, are you a muscle mommy guy or not?
Yeah.
Because she looks better than probably 50% of the wrestlers as far as.
Yeah, I just kept noticing the quick changes that had been made on her already with the different hair, the different clothes, and just trying to feminize her a little bit in comparison to what they were doing before, where she was standing there just like a jack dude.
Yeah, it also makes sense to show off her.
I mean,
you know,
she's technically the queen now, so
yeah, arms and legs and back and stuff, because she is chiseled.
So the reason these two guys are here is because the WWF wanted to start a light heavyweight division to compete with the cruiserweights over in WCW. So they made a deal with Michinoku Pro to help flesh it out. But my first opinion would be that they need to learn how to pronounce Japanese names.
Yes.
I mean, they don't have a Mike Tenay.
And, you know, maybe not have one of those guys that you bring over to start this thing be one of the guys that you... Then you take away the once upon a time existing WWF light heavyweight championship belt because you were worried that it was going to fall into the hands of somebody else. Didn't he win? Or am I thinking of somebody else? Who won the eight belts originally?
Yeah, Sasuke won the J Cup at one point.
Yeah, and then the WWF stripped their belt away from
it. Well, they stripped it once.
Psychosis. Ultimo Dragon.
I think it was Ultimo.
See, I thought they broke it off before then because they were worried about it falling into hands of somebody
technically
else.
At this point, I don't think they have called and asked for it back yet. I mentioned it at the last on the last Japan show, not realizing that this match was here.
Ah.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't think the actual phone call to be like, hey, we need our belt back has happened quite yet.
Also, I think that like they didn't give a shit about that belt until they decided to do this anyway.
Yeah.
And it's only because some of that's like they've been doing that stuff on WCW for about a year, but it took a while for people to start reacting to it. They had to get used to seeing they needed a reason to give a shit about Ultimate Dragon.
Yeah.
And now that they do care about Ultimate Dragon and Rey and all these guys, then it's taken off, and now the WWF has a reason to try something like that.
So the two men trade kicks, mat holds, and pin attempts to start, with Taka focusing on Sasuke's arm as a sign walks by in the background that says, "This is work rate."
I mean, yeah. Tell me when I'm telling lies.
More kicks traded between them when Mishinoku adds in slaps and a pair of drop kicks. But Taka is then sent out to the floor with a back body drop. Great Sasuke follows out with a missile drop kick before they return to the ring, where Sasuke stays on the attack with numerous kicks that leaves Michinoku laid out. And Taka catches a kick to counter into a dragon screw leg whip before hitting a drop kick that sends Great Sasuke out to the floor, with Michinoku flying out with a springboard body press, where there is a sign in the background that says, WCW, where the gay boys play.
Rude.
I mean, it's mostly funny just because it's just, you know, politically incorrect at this point that I can't help but get a kick out of it.
Taka looks to bring Sasuke in the hard way, only for him to float over and go for a German suplex. But Michinoku floats over and delivers a hurricanrana for a two count, followed by a law magistral for a near fall. And Taka starts running the ropes, only for Great Sasuke to hit him with a handspring back elbow that sends Michinoku out to the floor. So Sasuke follows out with an Asai moonsault. And they make their way back in to run the ropes, with Taka ducking a clothesline and nailing an overhead belly-to-belly for a two-count, before Michinoku hits a running knee and a missile dropkick. Taka then delivers the Michinoku driver for a near fall, heads up top to fly off, only be met in mid-air by a dropkick from Great Sasuke.
That was awesome.
Yeah, I mean, everything about this match is...
slaps.
Yeah, it's great stuff.
Michinoku is taken down with a springboard moonsault for a two count, followed by Sasuke hitting a thunder fire powerbomb and a tiger suplex for the pin and the win.
I mean, great shit. The crowd is hot for it, and they actually got me with the near fall, because it was the Asai moonsault, and I was like, oh, I thought it was over. How often does that happen, guys? We've watched so much wrestling that when you get tricked by a pinfall, it feels good. It's, you know, chasing the dragon.
So I got a fun fact for you. These two would rematch the next night on Raw. But while doing media, Great Sasuke would blab to the media that the plans were to make him the first light heavyweight champion.
Oh, man.
Dun, dun, dun.
Causing Vince to never use him again.
Damn, dude.
There's the Vinnie Mac we all know.
Also, Sasuke should have known better.
Everyone kind of knew that they were bringing him in to be the focal point of the division.
I mean, yeah, he's obviously the bigger name here.
Yeah, he's the biggest name. Like,
they're gonna get it.
They could get.
Yeah, like the New Japan guys aren't gonna come over.
They're not coming over because they have a deal with WCW.
Yeah, yeah, and they're also in a bigger promotion where they are making better money in Japan. So yeah, they'll come over every once in a while, but Sasuke had the potential to be the staple of a new division in WWE.
That's a very short excursion there for you, Mr. Sasuke.
And to be honest, I don't know if we ever see Great Sasuke ourselves ever again.
Wow.
I didn't look that up.
Yeah, yeah. But we'll see plenty of Taka.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a spot earlier in this match where I believe it was Sasuke comes off with, like, the first couple Mortal Kombat games where everybody does the same jump kick.
Kick outside, yeah, yes.
And it was, so I was like, Mortal Kombat kick.
Yeah.
Perfect looking.
I laughed at that, and then I was like, wait, did he hurt his ankle? Because mm-hmm. He looked like he totally missed him completely and just, like, looked like one of us as a kid doing that jump kick there.
It was a JCVD, like, blood sport, like, kick. It was great. Yeah, it's one of those things that, like, it looks great in film and video games, but in real life you're like, well, how do you land correctly with that?
You don't do it outside like that.
Yeah.
Do it inside where you land on the mat, not where you land on the floor.
Yeah, but it was really cool to see.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I totally forgot about
that. It makes sense that we don't see it very often. I had it in the notes, but it wasn't like as significant of a spot. It might have got glossed over in the recap a little bit, but I thought it was worth pointing out.
So we head backstage where Mankind and Triple H are still brawling, where Hunter gets rammed into a school bus, when China would grab Foley, allowing Triple H to take control, shoving him into kegs and breaking a shovel over his back.
Debus.
Yeah, it's the stick side first.
Hunter would drag Mankind onto some pallets and attempt a pedigree, only for Foley to backdrop Triple H instead. Mankind would shove Hunter into a side of a truck when officials would finally get the two men separated.
Or did they?
Guess we'll find out later on the show.
But before how long?
Back in the arena, McMahon speaks about the WWF title match, showing us footage of who The Undertaker was supposed to face. Ahmed Johnson.
I'm so sad.
Who was injured in a gang brawl on Raw.
I hate it.
Mm-hmm.
So the story behind this is that Farouk had fired Crush and Savio Vega from the Nation of Domination, promising a newer and blacker nation.
I was going to say, they're not black enough, obviously.
No.
The first new member was Kama Mustafa, former Papa Shango, Kama the Supreme Fighting Machine.
Future King of Hoes.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Which would lead to a tag match between Farouk and Kama versus Undertaker and Ahmed, where Johnson would end up turning on his partner and joining the Nation. And Ahmed would say no one had his back because he was black. And he didn't respect Taker because he took orders from Paul Bearer, making the dead man worse than a slave.
Whoa. It's pretty awesome to see Taker as a bit of a bitch.
Yeah.
It's weird and it's an interesting turn because he hasn't been super interesting for a while. But to make him sympathetic is fun and interesting. Also, the fans were behind Ahmed completely. But I'm not... Look at the guy. He looks so goddamn mean that he'd also make a great heel. Exactly. And he was over enough to become a heel that people were actually mad at because he turned on the Undertaker of all people.
And before Johnson could continue, Crush would arrive with his new group, a biker gang called the Disciples of Apocalypse. And they would brawl where Ahmed would end up getting hurt.
I feel like I've said this a few different times, but Crush ruins everything.
Yeah, it's a bummer because it seems like Ahmed Johnson is, for as big as he is, I think he should have gotten into yoga earlier in his life because he's kind of a Fabergé egg.
Yes.
And it sucks because he looks awesome in the ring. He continues to get better. He gets better at promos, and the fans have been behind him for a long time.
Yeah, time to
even just... in feuds that didn't feel that... That went on too long. He was still getting cheered.
Time to just change your name to AJ Glass or something, because dude just shatters easily.
Vincent sends it backstage to Doc with Bearer and Vader, where Hendricks accuses Paul of stooping to a new low, accusing the Undertaker of being a murderer. So how can he even look at the mirror at himself? And Paul responds that looking in the mirror is the best thing he does every morning.
If you know what he means.
But he wants to know how Taker can look in a mirror. He knows he murdered his family, and it will be deja vu when Vader whips him just like he did at the Rumble. Bearer asks for a replay of that encounter and gets his wish, as we're shown the footage of the Mastodon beating down the dead man. And Doc says Vader will win the title if it happens again. With Paul just saying, deja vu, Hendricks, deja vu. And making a face as he leaves the scene. So we get our third match. Vader with Paul Bearer versus The Undertaker for the WWF Championship.
Is this the earliest the WWF Championship has gone on ever?
I mean...
Second to last match.
Oh, I guess yeah, this show is only four matches.
Yeah.
I was like, that's five, right? And it's like, no, it's not. So, you know, totally makes sense. You can't have Brett not be in the Hart Foundation, not be at the end of the show.
No, you're going to have 12,000 angry Canadians.
Yeah.
So there's a story behind this match. We kind of have seen, we've gotten bits and pieces of it, but here's the full thing. Paul had made Taker team with the Mastodon. It ended with them fighting. So the dead man had enough and just walked away. So Bearer revealed the secret. Paul had worked for the Undertaker's parents in their funeral home, where they had two children. A sweet boy named Kane, and the red-headed demon spawn in Taker.
It's like, oh, what are your son's names? Oh, this one's Kane and this one's Undertaker.
He literally just kept calling him Undertaker.
Yeah.
Kane was encouraged to play with chemicals and smoke cigarettes by his brother. And one day, Bearer would arrive for work.
I fucking love chemicals and cigarettes.
And the funeral home was in flames, apparently having killed the dead man's parents and brother. Paul would spot the Undertaker lurking in some bushes and accuse him of starting the fire, only for Taker to say that Kane had started it by accident. The dead man would confront Bearer in the ring and demand that he tell the truth that Paul says he is, because Kane told him everything.
What? Kane's alive?
Yeah, this is pulled straight out of daytime television.
Yeah. So Vader enters, and I don't know if anyone else noticed, he has a new Titantron that includes footage of the Good Morning Kuwait incident, along with the word bully flashing on the screen.
Pretty cool.
Which I thought was pretty funny.
I agree.
I like that they're owning it.
Yeah. It's like, this guy's a real dickhead.
Undertaker would enter and raise the lights, causing an explosion which would startle the Mastodon. You can even see him say, "What the fuck is going on?"
He's been gone for a little while. I guess he forgot.
While Bearer hides underneath the mat.
Like, yeah, like, just trying to, like, peeking out from the apron.
Cowering.
Like, and Taker peeked from the bushes as a child.
Taker attacks as the bell rings with right hands, clotheslines, and a leg drop for a two count, followed by a corner splash for a near fall.
Taking it to him.
The dead man takes Vader to old school for another two count, but the Mastodon bounces out of a corner with an avalanche attack to slow the momentum, only for the Undertaker to rise and deliver a jumping clothesline for a near fall. Vader grabs a headlock, but Taker eventually shoves him off to nail a pair of big boots to send the Mastodon out to the floor. And the dead man follows out, but he's whipped into the steel steps, allowing Paul to taunt him. Undertaker then climbs up to the apron, with Vader grabbing him, only for Taker to drop down, snapping the Mastodon's throat across the ropes. And the dead man flies back into the ring with a top rope clothesline for a two count before several right hands sends Vader crashing out to the floor, allowing the Undertaker to stalk after Bearer, only for the Mastodon to attack from behind, followed by Paul swatting him with his shoe.
Murderer! I mean, drink every time he says murderer in this match, and yeah, you might not wake up tomorrow.
Taker makes his way back into the ring, where Vader takes control with stiff shots in a corner, a short arm clothesline, and a second rope clothesline for a near fall, before nailing a vertical suplex and a splash in the middle of the ring for a two count.
A thing I noticed about the Vader quote-unquote shoot-strike combo in the corner, it always looks kind of stiff. Here it looked like ass. He was not willing to quite bruise up the Undertaker as he does some of his other opponents, because sometimes you see those and you're like, damn, those don't look fun at all. And these ones, he was actually holding back.
And like, he kind of pissed off the last champ, so yeah. Maybe he kind of learned to...
He's like, well, I still want to get...
pull his punches a little bit so he can work more than once or twice a year.
Yeah, this is where my family lives, and this is who pays me the most. Going to Japan all the time is a little difficult.
Pissed off the last champ. They sent him overseas. He got locked up in Kuwait for 30 days.
Yeah. It's like, I guess I'll play nicer.
Yep.
The Mastodon locks on a nerve hold.
Get it.
But the dead man finds his way free, only for Vader to respond with eye pokes, a clothesline, and more stiff shots. When Undertaker again turns the tide with right hands of his own, grabbing the Mastodon for a chokeslam, which is escaped by kicking low. Vader then charges in with Taker lifting him up into a tombstone, but the Mastodon is able to reverse, only for them to stumble, leaving the dead man on top for a near fall.
Botch.
Undertaker charges into a back elbow, allowing Vader to deliver an avalanche attack and an elbow drop before going for a Vader bomb. But Taker rises and low blows the Mastodon, followed by a choke slam off the ropes for the pin. And no, Vader kicks out. The dead man hits another choke slam for a two count before lifting the Mastodon up into a tombstone pile driver for the pin. And the win. Post-match, Bearer throws a fit on the ramp while Undertaker celebrates, while Vince wonders if Kane is still alive, saying we could find out at SummerSlam.
Could we?
Bum, bum, bum. The, I do love that the Undertaker low blows Vader directly in front of the ref, who does nothing. But, you know, maybe he saw the other low blow.
I mean, he technically didn't hit him low.
I guess,
he
hit him in the thigh.
He hit him at eye level because he was up on the second row.
Okay, all right. But yeah, this is good. A good big man match in front of a hungry crowd. I mean, we've seen much worse matches involving The Undertaker and a larger man, or Vader and a larger man.
Yes.
Two consummate
This was a professionals. Good bro. It was fun.
Yeah.
McMahon then sends us to the Stampede parade footage again. But they realize that they've already showed it, so they stop it and transition to a recap of the main event build, with narration of brawls breaking out everywhere. Where we see footage of the Disciples of Apocalypse attack the Nation of Domination on Raw, followed by the Los Boricuas doing the same on another episode, which is Savio Vega's new group.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting... Yeah. Is this the beginning of
Game
like,
Wars?
Yes.
Yeah, we have like lots of factions. There's always like one or two like heel factions, but this is a lot for WWF and all at once, kind of.
Gang Wars 97.
The Hart Foundation are beating down someone when Ken Shamrock and Steve Austin would come to their aid, followed by Stone Cold delivering a stunner to Ken as well. Footage from WrestleMania 13. From the six-man match between Nation of Domination, Ahmed, and Legion of Doom is shown, before Austin doing damage to each member of the Hart Foundation. When narration comes back in with all of these altercations and clashes in the WWF, seemingly pale in comparison to the feud between Austin and the Hart Foundation.
I mean, what an intelligent way to do this.
The narrator continues with, although Stone Cold has certainly held his own, the tag team he will captain in Calgary to take on the Hart Foundation will even the odds and fuel the fury. Brett says the American fans cheer their scum heroes, but when they cross the border, it's a different story, and the Foundation will pound Austin's team into the dirt.
Which there's plenty of in Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
Yes.
The narrator returns again with 10 men, one brawl. The countdown to chaos in Calgary is complete. The moment of mayhem has arrived.
What great alliteration.
Wow!
And actually, after I heard this line, I went, and why does this this show not have a tagline? Because you have it right there.
And it's good.
It's good.
We don't get a lot of great ones.
10 men, one brawl, the countdown to chaos in Calgary.
I mean, come on. Perfect.
It's like, it's sitting right there for you, Vince.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe they came up with it before they printed the poster.
Could be. Or, yeah.
Doc Hendricks is then live with the American team in the back, saying they could be the underdogs tonight, with Goldust calling himself the Peacemaker, having put everything together, and if the Foundation wants to play Clint Eastwood, we can do that too. Shamrock calmly states he's faced unfriendly, unfamiliar, and untamable fights before, but when he enters his zone, it's time to get it on. An animal shouts about survival of the fittest.
Yeah, tell him, Hawk.
Well, Hawk only has one thing to say. What a rush! And Doc wants to ask Stone Cold a question, but Austin just walks away without saying a word.
I mean, such a sick play by Austin.
He's getting his Clint Eastwood on. He's not happy. No. He's feeling bad. Sad, whatever. He's got sunshine in a bag.
Okay. Jeez, I was like, where are you going?
Clint Eastwood, man.
I get it.
In the arena, the Fink asks everyone to rise for the Canadian national anthem.
Oh, sweet Lord.
To be performed by Farmer's Daughter. I found these facts out about Farmer's Daughter for you.
So. Okay, yeah, tell me about Farmer's Daughter.
I'm anxious to hear.
Their second album went gold in Canada.
Hey.
Had a number one Canadian country hit in Cornfields or Cadillacs.
Beautiful.
And they were named the best country group at the 1998 Juno Awards.
Okay. They have very 1997 hairstyles.
And clothes. They're all wearing like pleather.
Yes. It's
like, but baggy pleather.
It's like sixpence none the richer, just Canadian.
More hairspray.
Don't hate on Leah Nash that way, bro.
Matt knows her name. That's crazy.
I'm sorry.
The Fink also introduces the Premier of Alberta, the Honorable Ralph Klein, before also introducing Stu and Helen Hart, with Bruce literally standing right next to them. And he looks kind of mad that they didn't introduce him.
You're not the parents.
Yeah, I mean, you haven't been at every show that, like... Stu and Helen are basically WWF characters at this point. Yeah. Another thing, not to shit on Farmer's Daughter, but what an unremarkable...
Yeah.
Unremarkable singing of the Canadian National Anthem, which just really... Maybe it's just because I haven't heard it enough. It ain't got the hook. But I'm sure most national anthems are pretty bad.
So we go to our fourth match. Goldust. Ken Shamrock. The Legion of Doom of Road Warrior Hawk and Road Warrior Animal, and Stone Cold Steve Austin versus the Hart Foundation of Brian Pillman, Jim the Anvil Neidhart, British Bulldog, Owen Hart, and Brett the Hitman Hart.
Bulldog with Diana and Owen with two slammies.
And a new haircut.
Yep. Marlena is absent. She's at home with her kid.
Aww.
I love
that she's a super mom. A super person and a super corner person, as Vince says.
A super corner person. Okay.
Super corny.
I love that Vince McMahon points out that the reaction that Stone Cold Steve Austin might be about to get, just to like let everybody know at home that he's not a heel all the time. I thought that was fun. Because it's like, oh, this, we all know. I feel like even, I wasn't watching this at the time. You watched this happen, but everybody kind of knew that he was the guy and about to be the guy. Like, it's really, really obvious that. But it's, I mean, it, Vince makes it extra obvious with just like kind of warning everybody. It's like, we're in a different place where he might get booed.
Yeah,
that doesn't happen typically.
Everybody's known for over a year now that he's the guy. He's the guy. Let him be the guy. Just give him the ball. Let him run.
And also they're taking their time with it instead of smashing him over. Because, when you smash people over, you get things like Rocky sucks. Or the Ultimate Warrior, who was huge in as far as popularity and size, but doesn't work for an extended period of time, as all he can do is clothesline and shake rant. Ropes. And shake, yes, of course, shake the ropes.
Yep. I mean, you run the risk either way. You can either drop them instantly and hope they get over, or you can drag it out, and hope they don't get injured in the process.
Yeah, it's better to build when you have a guy that can do it all, and it's better to smash them over when you have a guy that can't do it all. See Ultimate Warrior, Bulldog, not Bulldog, Goldberg.
Yokozuna.
Mm-hmm. Yokozuna. Great examples.
Mm-hmm.
So... the story behind this match was that the Hart Foundation had made a challenge for anyone to face them in their home country, which we saw on the last pay-per-view. Stone Cold and his tag team champion partner, Shawn Michaels, were first in line to accept. But after a fist fight over the Sunny Days incident occurred, the Heartbreak Kid was sent home, forcing Austin to find some new partners. Goldust had failed in taking Bulldog's European title. Shamrock aided both him and Stone Cold in different brawls, while the Legion of Doom would also get involved to sway the odds to even.
Not a terrible way to clean that up.
And everyone's made it into the ring. They're staring each other down. And Ross would point out some extra cameras around ringside. They're filming a documentary about Brett.
Aww.
Yeah, I got excited about that.
And we'll cover that in a roughly 90 episodes or so.
Yeah. Well,
it's that documentary.
It's that documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
Gotcha.
I recently rewatched it. It's still very good, and there's plenty of footage from this time period, obviously, where, you know, they talk about this and show footage from this show, from behind the scenes and all that stuff. It's great. Still holds up. I mean, I think that and Beyond the Mat are the best wrestling documentaries. There's plenty of other good ones, but those ones kind of just capture a vibe and a time better than most.
Mm-hmm.
More candid.
It was unseen at the time.
Oh. And Austin does still get mostly cheers when he comes out. There's boos, but there's mostly cheers on his way out still. Even though the Hart Foundation in-ring is going to get the majority of the crowd behind them, obviously. The people just can't help themselves with this rising star.
So Hitman and Stone Cold are left in the ring as everyone makes their way to the apron. And they start brawling, with Hart getting the advantage to nail an atomic drop, a clothesline, and a rake of the eyes on the ropes. Austin slows the momentum with a low blow and begins to stomp a hole in the Hitman, before locking on the million-dollar dream, only for Hart to climb the ropes and roll backwards for a two count.
Love the callback.
You guys see the LOD sign? Ladies of Drag. It's like, I mean, I don't know. They have makeup on, but it's not the same thing.
Daughter? I was going to say.
Also, early in this match, my thought is, who's eating the pin? Because it's either going to, in my head, it's like, is it Goldie or Shamrock? Because I don't see it being a member of LOD, even though Hawk, with all of his transgressions, probably has earned one. But I can't see the Hart Foundation losing either.
I always assumed it was Gold Dust.
Me too. So it was just my thought going into the match.
Yeah, Shamrock's still too new.
Yeah.
Unless it was Neidhart, but I didn't think the Hart Foundation
exactly.
Was losing.
But yeah, it was just kind of interesting because it's like, well, Gold Dust is in a cool down spot at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I knew the outcome of it, but.
I did not.
I would have assumed if the Hart Foundation is losing, then it'd be Pillman because he's not technically a member of the Hart family. And then on the other side, I'd say the same thing. You know, I'd throw Animal or Gold Dust in there. I don't know why.
So Stone Cold chokes Brett on the ropes, followed by a running straddle, but Hitman moves in time, sending Austin crashing into the ropes. Neidhart is brought in for some damage, only for Stone Cold to duck a clothesline and hit a thuz press before tagging in Shamrock. An Anvil ducks a roundhouse kick, but Ken gets him with a second one, allowing him to apply the ankle lock, only for Pillman to make a save. Shamrock works over Neidhart until Anvil can tag in Flying Bryant, so Ken begins to work him over until a rake of the eyes and chops puts Pillman in control. Bryan hits a backbreaker and he goes for a cover, just to grab Shamrock's hand and tap it on the mat, but the ref doesn't fall for it.
Beautiful.
Pillman charges into a corner, only for Ken to fire out with a clothesline, followed by a belly-to-belly suplex, allowing both teams to make tags. Gold Dust back body drops Owen, who retaliates with an enziguri, only for the Golden One to respond with a turnbuckle smash and a 10 count of right hands in the corner. Hawk now tags in to keep the attack with more chops, a gut-wrench suplex, and a leg drop for a near fall, before nailing a body slam, a leaping fist drop, and a top rope splash for a 2 count. And the Road Warrior sends Owen to the ropes and goes for a drop kick, but Hart stops himself in time, allowing him to lock on a sharpshooter, which is broken up by Animal. Bulldog then comes in with a vertical suplex to Hawk for a near fall, delivers the running power slam, but the cover is broken up by Gold Dust. Brett returns to face Animal, who hits several shoulder blocks, but he charges right into a boot from the hitman, allowing Hart to clothesline him down. And the Road Warrior realizes that he's in a bad spot, so he makes a tag to the Golden One, where they go into a test of strength.
JR does a great call here, where he says, the son of legend Dusty Rhodes versus the son of legend Stu Hart, which I thought was really great.
Yep.
I don't feel like they talk much about Goldust being the son of Dusty Rhodes.
No.
And it makes more sense now that he's...
He's
kind of just been like, he's been face, he's been heel.
The initial startup with Goldust was they were trying to do as much as possible to keep the Dusty side of it out.
Yeah, because it works for
the
company.
But with the JR interviews with Mankind, where they were, you know, bringing in Mrs. Foley's baby boy, and, you know, referring to him by his name, they started doing those with Goldust and Marlena and other superstars. So the facts of Goldust were brought to the surface to make him more of a real person instead of a character.
Yeah, kind of. It's interesting. It's kind of like, as far as like the two major comic book companies, it's like, oh, a lot of people, like Marvel characters are relatable, when DC characters famously are less relatable. And it's like, it seems like that WWF is trying to make their characters more relatable. Personal issues draw money. And
daddy issues.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, same with The Undertaker. It's like, oh, if he's just an undead zombie that's like unkillable, if he's Michael Myers with like under eye makeup on, then like it's not particularly relatable. But
well, yeah, they're going one route with everybody else of bringing reality to the surface, and then with Taker they're
going full
this
soap opera.
Whole soap opera, yeah. Story of him murdering his family, and
which also makes him more relatable as he's beaten down, humiliated. It humanizes him in a way that we've never seen before.
Who hasn't, you know, had their little brother purposely play with chemicals and smoke cigarettes?
That's what I had my sister do all the time. Yeah.
Like I said, I love chemicals and cigarettes.
Brett hits a knee to the gut to gain control, placing Goldust in a tree of woe, with everyone getting a shot in until the other team makes the save, leading to everyone brawling momentarily. Owen takes over with a backbreaker of the Golden One, but he misses on a charge into a corner, allowing Animal to come in to stomp away, only for Hart to duck a clothesline and deliver a wheel kick and a missile dropkick. Owen then goes for a hurricanrana, but Animal catches and drops him with a powerbomb, before nailing a power slam and lifting Hart for the Doomsday Device, only for Anvil to make the save, which leads to another brawl from everybody except Austin, who takes advantage, dragging Owen to a corner and wrapping his knee around the post.
Posted multiple
followed
times.
By a chair shot as well.
Crack it over the knee.
Now Bruce Hart attacks Stone Cold from behind, but it's too late, as Owen is hurt and officials have to help him to the back.
Oh no.
Now the rest of the Foundation team up for a beating on Austin inside the ring.
And because of this chair spot and posting of the knee, the crowd, we get an Austin sucks chant. Is this the first and last time? Or no, I mean, I guess the last time we'll see one for a while, because we've seen a little bit before when he came in as a heel.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just funny. I got a real good kick out of it.
The rest of the Foundation team up for a beating on Austin inside the ring, until Stone Cold rallies to free himself, dragging Pillman in to nail a stunner. But Brian rolls away, allowing Brett to trip up Austin, wrapping his knee around a post.
Reap what you sow.
And smashing it with the fire extinguisher, forcing officials to help Stone Cold backstage for medical attention.
Hmm. Look how that worked out.
Eye for an eye.
Knee for a knee.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I apologize.
Hawk and Bulldog start going at it in the ring, with the Road Warrior hitting a body slam and climbing the ropes, only for Davey Boy to trip him up, causing Hawk to crotchy himself for a two count. Anvil joins Bulldog for a double clothesline, which allows Hawk to roll away for a tag to Animal, who goes into another test of strength, with Neidhart hitting a cheap shot to bring the Hitman back in for an old Hart Foundation favorite of a second rope elbow to a held Road Warrior across the knee for a near fall.
What was that called? The heart attack?
No, the heart attack's when they hold him up.
Hold him up and close
like a
bear
hug and clothesline. That's okay. Clothesline.
That was like the demolition elbow kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brett telegraphs a back body drop, allowing Animal to take in Shamrock, who doesn't seem to know what to do. So Pillman runs in with the clothesline, allowing the hitman to headbutt the gut.
Pillman with the save for the green guy.
Hart with a turnbuckle smash, but a reversed whip sends Brett chest first into a corner, where Ken again doesn't seem to know what to do with the leg.
He's lost in the sauce.
The hitman bakes it back to his feet and tosses Shamrock out to the floor, where Brian throws him into an announce table. Now Animal and Bulldog start brawling around ringside, while Hawk and Anvil are doing the same, with Neidhart sending his Road Warrior into the steel steps. Ken's rolled back in, where the hitman delivers a side Russian leg sweep, makes the cover, only for Goldust to make the save. Now Davey Boy comes in to work over Shamrock, only for Ken to go low and tag in the Golden One, who nails a clothesline and a Bulldog to Bulldog. Goldust goes for the curtain call, when Pillman would jump in to make the save. So the Golden One climbs to the top, only for Davey Boy to knock him down, causing Goldust to crotch himself and allowing Bulldog to deliver a superplex for a two count. Austin is then seen limping his way back to the ring. He climbs up to the apron and he gets tagged in so that he can stomp away on Brett, sending him sternum first into a corner, followed by a snap suplex for a near fall. Stone Cold then telegraphs a back body drop, allowing the hitman to DDT.
Yeah!
Before a backbreaker, second rope elbow drop, and a sleeper, only for Austin to nail a jawbreaker to escape. Stone Cold then goes for a sleeper of his own, but Hart floats over and takes Austin down, locking on the sharpshooter. But Animal runs in to break it up.
Quickly.
Stone Cold then applies the sharpshooter to Brett, when Owen would run back down to break that up. The hitman tags his brother in, but telegraphs a back body drop. So Austin kicks him to the ropes, followed by a clothesline that sends Owen out to the floor. And Stone Cold rams Owen into the guardrail before tossing him back in, when Bruce would throw a drink at Austin. But Stone Cold thinks it was Stu, though Bruce made it super obvious that it was him.
Yeah, for sure.
And I just love the fact that, like, we're not giving you any camera time. Fuck you, I'm going to beat up your dad.
I mean, it's more messed up if he's beating up an old man. Also, it's like, yeah, they did the spot of whip into the steel was directly in front of the family, pointed. So it's like, oh, that's why he threw the drink, because his old parents are there. I mean, they're decrepit. Stu can barely move.
Austin attacks Papa Hart. So Bruce and Keith Hart jump the railing to help Brett beat down Stone Cold until he can be rolled in. And Austin wants to go after Brett again, only for Owen to cradle him up from behind for the pin
and the win.
Post-match, everybody's brawling again. Keith and Bruce come in to help as well until security and officials can break up the fight.
And maybe a fan.
The Hart family and Foundation celebrate in the ring when Stone Cold would run back down with a chair, only for the Harts to jump him once more. Officials break it up again with security cuffing Austin and dragging him away. But he continues to just flip off the crowd, even with his hands behind his back.
I mean, it's so sick. It might be Brett's hometown show, but it's really Austin's show.
And now all of the Hart family starts making their way into the ring, waving little Canadian flags. And we get Stu, Helen, Diana makes her way in, Davey Boy Jr., Natalia,
Oh Harry,
Tyson Kidd, Teddy Hart is there.
Yeah, it's very sweet and sad to see
Teddy Hart, the only time he'll appear on WWE TV. Yeah.
But there was also a random kid that made it into the ring as well. And the hitman was like, hey kid, what are you doing here? And then just told him, just wave to the crowd and enjoy it.
Yeah, that's, I mean, of course. Like,
here's a tidbit on me.
People might talk about Brett being a crybaby, but by no means is he like an asshole or a bad guy.
No.
I got a little misty seeing Owen just holding a child at all, whether it was his or not. I was like, bummer.
Yep. And see, I'm glad I'm not the only one, because I'm as we were reading through all these names here, it was like, I didn't even think to look to see if Natalia was there. I thought I saw somebody that looked like Teddy at one point, but my eyes stayed strictly on Owen because I'm not used to seeing him in a family setting like that, other than, you know, with his brothers in the ring.
Well, it was when I saw Tyson, I was like, Tyson and Natalia got married. I'm like, why is he... But he had moved in with the family while he was training with Stampede.
Oh, okay.
So that's why he was with them.
Yeah.
Because I was just like, they get married. They're not family. I'm like,
okay. What is he actually doing here? And it's like, oh, okay, yeah.
Oh, so they were groomed years ago to be together.
Eh? Hey, man, you know, yeah. You typically develop feelings for the people you spend time with. So as long as they're not blood related, it's fine.
So I ask you, gentlemen, what are your overall thoughts of In Your House 16, Canadian Stampede?
I mean, good show. The last match is so well done. Perfect finish. This is, like, I always complain about Survivor Series matches because I'm like, okay, well, we threw people together and I don't feel particularly invested. Here, I'm invested. This is a perfect Survivor Series style WWF match. Even though LOD's there, they're like kind of the weak link, but we know that stuff got moved around. Not weak link as in like I dislike them or they're not capable. It's just
more of a what are you doing here?
Yeah, but it really is like it could be Austin and any amount of guys that are capable in ring and it would probably work. And these are the, you know, for the most part, the most capable guys that aren't in singles matches in the company. And Ken Shamrock's really the only one that got lost for a second. But hey, it wasn't for long. It wasn't so long that it ruined anything. And everybody else around him was smart enough to know what to do.
Yeah. Ah, I love the show. I mean, coming from the last In Your House, where I think we all agreed it was one of the worst shows that we'd seen in quite some time.
Worst WWF show.
Total 180. Yeah, this one.
Hot crowd helps.
Sweet. They put the focus on only things that mattered on the screen and narrowed it down to four easy, fun, adventurous, exciting matches. And
and the whole show is basically nothing but like potential champions or worthy champion opponents, with the exception of Michinoku and Sasuke, who have a banger of a match. Like everybody else on the card is a action figure worthy wrestler.
Yep.
Sorry, Sabio.
Yeah, this is one of the best WWF shows we have ever watched. And it might even be in top 10 of shows we've watched all together.
Mm-hmm.
Everything
works. It would depend on how I rank those Japan shows, because we know we love those.
Yeah, and a lot of the times those are compilations, like when we do the tournaments and stuff. And it's like, well, it's not one show.
And this has to be one of the hottest crowds.
Oh, hell yeah.
That we have ever seen at a show. And it makes it just that much better.
Yeah, I mean, everything on the show is already good, but it's adds an extra like 25% of like enjoyment and excitement.
Extra because, half star.
Yeah, at least.
Good, where's the smart marks at?
There.
Alright, fuck you.
I think it's time we smark it up. We're going to switch it up this week. What are some of the most disappointing moments of this show? And I'll start off, because it's the biggest disappointment that I could have, especially in myself, is that my computer messed up, and I don't have the rest of this episode. So I'm going to record the rest of it by myself, but we'll have to kind of run through Shane and Michael's thoughts all by ourselves. So to continue on the most disappointing, we were definitely disappointed in Bruce Hart. The whole throwing of the finish kind of the main event. Like we were just like, Bruce wants to be the center of attention on this and it's not about him. It was just very weird. I know Michael was like, when he said Kevin Hart, meaning Keith, jumped in the ring, jumped out to ringside, they were making it way too much about themselves. I know I thought the cowboy hats were kind of disingenuous. Like, JR wearing one makes sense. He always wears one. The others, especially Lawler, it felt like he was making fun of that Calgary is a bit of a cow town. Ahmed Johnson, he finally gets his moment. And then, of course, Crush and his gang, which we all know Shane doesn't like Crush, so he's always a disappointment for Shane. The Triple H Mankind finish of the match. If it had ended with just the double count out, I think it would have been a disappointment. But by them continuing the fight backstage, it actually stepped up the intensity of it and definitely leads us towards another matchup down the road. Moving on to our best moments, because this show definitely had more good moments, because we absolutely adored this show. The crowd was super hot. The light heavyweight match, we decided to add it to our short list. Like, I don't think we said it while we were covering the match, but it makes so much sense. Taka and Sasuke, like, just knocked it out of the park in the middle of, you know, some of the biggest names in WWF at the time. Shane really enjoyed Austin throwing the birds while he was in the handcuffs. I think we decided that this is like the first time he's ever done that. And he couldn't keep his eyes off of Owen during the final little segment with the entire family in the ring, which the entire family coming into the ring was very, very cool as well. And Michael definitely said that the main event is what he wants from Survivor Series style matches. The finish of it was perfection, he thought. Just with the whole fight between Brett and Austin, and then it's Owen that sneaks in to get the win. There's a good reason for it, because you kind of have to separate Brett and Austin, because, I mean, we all know what happens at Survivor Series with Brett and Shawn, but if Brett were to stick around, the main event for WrestleMania 14 is Brett and Austin. I mean, that's what they're completely building towards, but they have to separate them a little bit before they can bring them back together. And doing a little side quest with Owen while Brett goes and, spoiler alert, he goes and becomes the number one contender. And we'll see him in a match for the belt very soon. Moving on to best performer, I mean, obviously Austin. This show was in Canada with the majority of the fans cheering for all of the Hearts and the Heart Foundation. But this was about Austin. The pop that he got was just kind of insane. Like, even with the few boos that he did, like, the entire rest of Austin's team was booed. And then Austin comes out, and yes, there are boos, but he gets so many cheers as well. I also thought, like I said earlier in best moments, the crowd was hot. They got my best performer because they gave this show an extra half star. Like, they were so great. Surprising, most surprising of the show, we all kind of agreed Owen getting the pin was a bit surprising, especially on Austin. Because, I mean, we talked about it before we started talking about the match. We really thought that Goldust or possibly Neidhart would get pinned, not Austin. And we also always assumed that Brett or Austin would get the pin. And it was none of those. It's completely subverted our expectations. And so that's definitely why it's surprising. And then, like I said, whenever I mentioned the light heavyweight match being on our shortlist, it's in the midst of legends of wrestling being on this show, and they stood out, in our opinion. And now for a look back even further into the history of wrestling.
The dusty finish.
Ravishing Rick Rude had won the WCW International World Heavyweight Championship in Japan. But by May 22nd, 1994, at Slamboree, he had been stripped of the title due to the use of the belt during his match, with the WCW Championship Committee giving the title back to Sting. But the Stinger refused it, saying the belt should be won in the ring, and agreed to wrestle Vader that night. The match quickly became a slugfest, with Vader gaining control to hit a pair of pump splashes and an avalanche attack. The ref would be taken out when Sting misses a clothesline, so Vader follows up with a choke slam, while Harley Race goes to use a chair, only to hit his client instead. The Stinger would capitalize with a DDT, but gets caught going for a splash in the corner, followed by Vader power slamming him. Vader would head up top for a moonsault, only for Sting to avoid and make a cover, when Race would fly in with a diving headbutt, but the Stinger moves in time, causing Vader to take the blow. Sting would follow up with a top rope splash for the pin to become the WCW International World Heavyweight Champion for the second time. Sting would then make his way to the next Clash of Champions for a unification match with his long-time rival. Next week, Bash at the Beach 1997, the 1 year anniversary of the NWO. So we got to go back to Daytona Beach for that show. We're going to have some fun. So the music from this week's show is Hard City by First Calm Music. And Owen Hart won our main event. So we're going to play his theme music, High Energy, by Jimmy Hart and J.J. McGuire. If you like this episode or any of our other ones, please go out there, rate and review us on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcasts at. As Michael says, five stars or no stars. And if you have any questions, comments, concerns, Shane usually chimes in with recipes. So if you know anything from Daytona Beach or Florida in general, I know we're headed to Philly here pretty soon. Give you some help with those. You can send any of that stuff to our email at WrestlingHistoryX@gmail.com or find us on X at WrestlingHistoX. That's Wrestling HistoX. We'll talk to you next week.
Laters!